Right. What is your desire concerning this bill before we sit today?
Well, I would, if Mr. Chairman, if I understood the testimony from the folks from the Park and Rec District, from what I heard them say, they're within the confines of this bill now. They're not beyond the confines because they're only assessing these fees based upon an imputed number of employees based upon new construction or new development. That being the case, I think it would be prudent for this committee to pass the bill the way it's written, because it draws the line there and it says you can't go beyond that. In other words, you can't start assessing fees now simply because there's no new construction or development, simply because new employees have been hired. It makes it clear to government entities that you can't impose assistance development charges just on the hiring of an employee, that there would have to be new construction.
Okay.
That's what I heard their testimony to be. Anyhow, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, what I heard was that the calculation that you thought was taking place doesn't take place, so why do we need the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, I think the reason we need the bill is I think the next natural step is to start assessing it strictly on the employment relationship without any development implicit in the assessment.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair, there's no way to do that now, Representative Witt.
Right now
it's real clear what systems development charges are for, and it's for new construction, period. There's no way to read it differently.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, I'm not sure that's true. And in fact, I think this has been an area of active consideration for a number of districts. And I think this would make legislative intent very clear that unless there's some kind of construction and development, you cannot impose a fee based upon the hiring of an employee.
Okay, I'm done, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Witt, I don't have a problem with moving this bill. I would be happy if you would want to talk with the individuals from Tualatin before we did so. Strictly up to you.
Yeah, I would add, Mr. Chairman, this bill's been out for at least 6 weeks. And these folks, I'm not aware of any effort they made to contact me. I've tried to contact them over the last 2 days. They did call back one time, but I've been in the building here all day today, and I have not heard from them and run into them here at the hearing.
Thank you. Anything further? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Be happy to entertain a motion. Pardon me. We'll conclude the public hearing on 3172, and we'll open a work session on 3172.
Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I'd like to move House Bill 3172 to the floor with the Duke Pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves House Bill 3172 to the floor with the Duke Pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just slow today, but I mean, I listened to all the testimony and it sounds like Representative Witt thought that there was one city that was inappropriately charging system development charges.
Mm-hmm.
We've had that one city testify that that's not the case. So I don't know why we need this bill, so I guess I'll just be a no vote, because if it's not broke, why fix it?
All right. Have a motion? Clerk?
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
No.
Bowman?
No.
Deckert?
No.
Arthur?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sinceri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye. Oh, excuse me. Let me pull that back.
Wilson?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I serve notice of possible minority report.
Motion carries. And Representative Chair, then.
Okay.
I also serve notice, Mr. Chair.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 3172.
Okay.
And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2724.
Yeah.
Much revelry in this committee, Mr. Chairman.
Beautiful. Yeah. Okay, we'll call forward to testify Mary Botkin. Ask me, and Mary, if you'd like to bring along some company, you're welcome to do that, please.
Mary Botkin? What is it?
Yeah.
You know, listen to me.
And please, don't fight over our bill.
I want it. I want it. I want it.
You can have it.
Let's refer it.
That's necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And I'm not going to take very long at all, because we have folks here who can talk about this bill better than I can. What this bill does is it moves 911 emergency communications operators into the police and fire category of PERS and acknowledges their career commitment to the as part of the public safety team. I'm going to quote one of my close friends who's a 911 operator and is not going to be here to testify, or is not going to testify today. The first time I really started working with 911, she was explaining to me how they do their job and what their job entails. And very succinctly, she informed me one time that it's not an emergency till I say it's an emergency. Up until that point, it's just folks talking to each other on radio. And I think with that, the best folks to talk about what they do and how they do it and the stresses of their job are the folks who work in the business. And with us, I have Tony and Deborah, who both work at 911 Portland and CCOM, I'm sorry. And with that, I'm going to step away from the table and let them
relax.
Have at it, and I will be here if they have problems answering any questions you may have.
Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name's Anthony Collins, and I'm a DPSST certified 911 telecommunicator. And I work for CCOM, which is Clackamas County 911. We currently dispatch for 5 police agencies, including Clackamas County Sheriff's Department, and we dispatch for 10 different fire districts, including Fire District Number 1 in Clackamas County. I've been doing this job for 12 years total, 7 years at CCOM, where I presently work, and 5 years at an out-of-state dispatch center. I'd first like to provide you with a little bit of history of dispatching. In the past, dispatch functions were predominantly handled by sworn personnel in both police and fire applications. During the 1960s, local governments began phasing in civilian personnel to dispatch positions as a cost-cutting measure. Early telecommunicators didn't have any benefits of training to handle situations effectively on telephones or on radios because they were basically trained in radio codes or little else. In this day and age, dispatching has become a profession all its own. In 1995, Oregon became one of the first states in the nation to recognize this importance by requiring all 911 telecommunicators be state certified. Certification requirements must be met each year and include demonstrated knowledge in the following: 911 telephone systems, CAD, which is computer-aided dispatching systems, MDTs, which are mobile data terminals in public safety vehicles, EMD, which is emergency medical dispatch, and crisis intervention, including domestic violence, hostage negotiation, and suicide prevention. A study done by Dennis M. Payne, a retired lieutenant colonel of the Michigan State Police, indicates that telecommunicators processing police calls for service are the most critical point in the criminal justice system. In 1997, DPSST, which is the Police Board of Standards and Training, figures show that there were 960 certified telecommunicators in the state. Most recent figures show that that number has dropped to 875, which helps substantiate the fact that all of our major 911 centers in the state are working understaffed, and that increases the load on the remaining telecommunicators. With success rate in training of new telecommunicators ranging from 30 to 60%, coupled with a small pool of people that are either able or willing to do this job, the situation isn't going to change anytime soon. The shortage helps fuel burnout, and statistics say that most telecommunicators have an average career span of only 5 to 10 years. Out of 310 Oregon telecommuters that we polled, only 20% have 15 or more years of experience. By including emergency telecommunicators in the early retirement system, you would be acknowledging their role as an integral part of the public safety team. and this also may serve to attract qualified people to this profession, thus enhancing public safety by better providing staffing for our 911 centers and less burnout on veteran telecommunicators. It has been said that dispatching is the third highest stress level position in the country, surpassed only by air traffic controllers and police officers. Dispatcher stress is very different from police stress in that our stress load is continual without break, experiencing one emergency incident after another and not being able to be there in person. We are the human being on the end of electronic lifeline for those who are in harm's way, be it citizen, officer, firefighter, or sometimes all three simultaneously. It has been only in the last few years that psychologists have determined that telecommunicators, as well as police officers and firefighters, suffer from cumulative stress, critical incident stress, and post-traumatic stress disorders. All of these stressors are dangerous as they can progress unrecognized. Untreated, they can create other illnesses and disorders that diminish quality of life at work and home. This is why we could say that most telecommunicators can't remember any friends that have retired due to length of service, just due to medical reasons. There are other stresses related to work environment that also cause for concern. An example would be the lack of opportunity for upward mobility within agencies due to lacking staffing conditions or positions that exist above us. I know firsthand on both sides of the fence as to how this profession affects home life, as I am not only a telecommunicator, but I spent the first 12 years of my life as a son of another telecommunicator. In closing, I'd like to share some samples of some things telecommunicators endure that were written by another dispatcher, a Renee Meander from Virginia. She's done a good job of summarizing some of these stressors. They come under different topics. Training. Work with need to know only. Learn high volumes of information in a short period of time. The workload is overwhelming and constant. Other jobs, you get to learn at your own speed. This job is learn it now and get it right the first time or somebody dies. Serious traumas. I think about the secure work environment that which we work in. Imagine being the one sitting at the radio and the only thing you can do is listen to what is happening. Trust me, the mind's eye can paint a picture that is 10 times worse than what is on the scene. Hurry up and wait. While officers can punch the gas pedal and physically do something to assist another officer, the dispatcher has to start the process and then wait. Your adrenaline is sky high. Every bit as high as the officer pushing the gas pedal. Only while an arriving officer is bailing out from his car and taking care of business, this half of the team waits and waits and waits some more. Policies. Multitask, multi-agency, multi-protocols that change daily. Only the dispatcher has to know everyone from each agency and know them now. No time to look it up. The radio request is there. Make a decision. Public and press. The armchair quarterbacks who have never been in the telecommunications center or have never worn a badge or a headset. Police bashing extends to dispatchers, and we feel every blow. Family and friends. What do you mean you can't be here for your daughter's birthday? What do you mean you're working Christmas? Can't you take it off? Self-blame. I could have done more, couldn't I? It's my fault. Responder, injury, or death. There's nothing worse than the injury or death of an officer or a firefighter. Something happens to a dispatcher who loses one. Just as the officers and firefighters themselves go through the horrific transformation. The backdraft cliche couldn't be more true. You go, we go. And I'd like to add a topic of my own. Technology. You might say that technology should make the job easier, but in fact, many of the improvements that have been made in technology actually make the job more complex. Technology actually creates more work for telecommunicators because we wind up doing more tasks than we were able to do in the past. I'd like that you please recognize our important contribution to the public safety team by including 911 telecommunicators and police and fire retirement. And we also recognize that you're busy during your session, so we've got a couple of things for you to listen to. Well, we've got a tape of a police pursuit, and then we've also got a couple of 911 calls. The police pursuit, I'd like for you to pay attention, if you could, that the dispatcher remains very calm and starts directing the actual situation. Thank you.
Westbound Mitchell from 6 to your gate
employee. Westbound Mitchell, down to Blizzard Coast, northbound 60 from Mitchell.
Northbound 60 from Mitchell. Car starts that way.
While that dispatcher was doing that, she was constantly typing in everything that was going on in the computer and translating it into computer code from actual plain speech. So dealing with that plus that at the same time.
Yes, can I please get the police? But this man got a fucking gun right now. My mama just told me to call the police on 8.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Deborah Kidney. Those calls were normal calls for us. Luckily, we don't often take them back to back, but I've known many people who have had to take those types of calls back to back. I'm an emergency telecommunicator, a 911 dispatcher. I work at the largest dispatch center in the Northwest, the Bureau of Emergency Communications in Multnomah County. We dispatch for 5 police agencies, 4 fire bureaus, and the county's emergency ambulance provider. We take 1 million calls a year. I've been doing this challenging job for over 9 years. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it takes to be a 911 telecommunicator, and then why we should be included in police and fire PERS. My perspective is that of a large center, but I can assure you that no matter what size the center, the experiences, the issues, and the problems are the same. Academics have looked at the skills it takes to be a telecommunicator in a 911 center and estimate that only 2% of the population have the necessary skill set. And I can tell you that not very many of the able 2% are interested in doing this job. We're talking about people who must be able to make instantaneous and virtually 100% correct decisions, who can type nearly as fast as an excited officer or a frantic caller can talk, who can sort out what's being said on the radio by a fire chief in charge of a 3-alarm fire, and translate it into a computer command that gets him the resources he needs, people who can calm a hysterical mother down and convince her to do CPR on her probable SIDS baby. People who can juggle three requests from officers, two simultaneous pursuits, and remember to get in line to go to the bathroom. It's a job that is stimulating, exciting at times, frightening, never the same twice, and the word most often associated with it, stressful. At my center, the training it takes to be able to master all aspects of the job take 12 to 18 months. We currently lose from 30 to 50% of those who begin in our program. That's after they've had taken four different tests, gone through two interviews, a background investigation, a psychological exam, and a six-week academy. Once they begin on the job, they often find they don't have the skills, speed, confidence, or desire to do this job. 911 telecommunicators are an essential and key part of the public safety team. They are the public's first contact with the system. We must gather the information needed by the responding crews in a timely and coherent way, and when dispatching, give that same information back clearly. We are the resource for those on the other end of our radios. I often tell new 911 employees that a good telecommunicator, like any emergency responder, builds a protective shell around their heart. They have to be able to deal with their first 10 real emergency calls. But that shell can't be too thick, because we must also empathize with those we are serving. We must be able to reach out to the scared teenager from a dysfunctional family who's been kicked out of her home and has nowhere to go. We have to comfort our elderly callers who are confused and don't even know that they're in a care center. We have to listen to the father who is trying to resuscitate his toddler who fell into the swimming pool. And we have to hear the pain of an officer who's been shot and is calling us for help. The downside to keeping that protective shell in place and yet thin enough is that without your invitation, people get under your defenses and they stay with you forever. This is the stress. I can handle the 98% of the calls, even the emergency ones, that come in. But after 9 years in this job, I carry a small crowd of citizens with me every day on shift and off shift. I will always live with the woman who found herself in the middle of a gun battle, a wounded stranger in her house, her children hiding in the closet, the gunman outside, and me on the other end of the line, providing a hopefully calming voice, telling her that help was on the way. I will always live with the bright, articulate 18-year-old whose first name was the same as my daughter's, who was scared, vomiting, and alone in a phone booth in downtown Portland. She had overdosed on heroin, which she had been taking since she was 15, and knew that she was in real trouble. I will always live with the father who came home one night to find his wife and three children unconscious and not breathing. When I encouraged him to do CPR, he asked me, "Which one should I do it on?" I will always live with the fear that one of my officers, my firefighters, my paramedics will be hurt and I may be the last voice they hear. We're asking you today to include us as members of the public safety team in the most meaningful way possible, to add us to police and fire PERS retirement. The best analogy that I can think of for this job is one of a professional athlete. Professional athletes have to be in top form and condition throughout their short careers. Through the normal process of aging, athletes slow down and lose the edge that keeps them in the elite of the sports world. Dispatchers also must keep their edge in a job that demands a high level of intellectual acumen, a prodigious memory for details, and mental conditioning. Our clients, the people who call us for help, and the public safety agencies we dispatch, must have a telecommunicator who can respond instantaneously, because instants count in an emergency. Including us with our coworkers and police and fire PERS would provide telecommunicators a chance to finish their careers while still performing at their peak. 1 week ago today, a horrible thing happened in Colorado. I actually saw it on the news here when I was down, thinking this hearing would be last week and not this week. And the first thing I thought of was, I'm a parent of two high school students, and I thought of my kids. And the next thing that I thought of, and the thing that has haunted me for the last week, are the dispatchers who were on the line with those students for hours, as they waited for the help to come in. They had to tell them they didn't know what was happening. They had to help them. give first aid to their wounded teacher and not be able to tell them when someone is going to come and relieve them. There will be a large price to pay for that tragedy, just as there is for any other, and that's among the heroic firefighters, the heroic policemen, and the dispatchers who were on the other ends of those lines and are just as affected. I began this job when I was 31, and now at age 40, I don't have the speed that I once did. I cannot imagine myself dispatching pursuits in 20 years at age 60. I'm amazed and inspired by my coworkers who've done this job for 15, 20, and more years. This bill is for them. They're brave and strong, and they deserve the recognition and reward that including them as a legitimate part of the public safety team will bring. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, next up will be Barry, 911 dispatcher from Lane County. Barry, I'm sorry, I can't read your last name.
That's okay. Can I do everybody a favor? I'm going to take 2 minutes of your time to do more.
Sure.
My last name is Howarth, Barry Howarth.
Thank you.
With Central Lane Communications in Eugene. And I was the first person to take a call from Thurston High School about this time last year. It's part of my job. But there's only two things I really want to talk about in this next minute and 30 seconds, and that is from the practical application. I've been working with employee attrition for about the last 8 years professionally, trying to help organizations reduce the amount of turnover in their 911 centers. It's rampant throughout the United States. It's not atypical to see 25 to 30% turnover. Where I work, we have about 12 or 18% turnover, depending upon what time of year. And that's in Eugene. We're probably the second largest PSAP in the state. And what I've seen is that this lack of continuity with the service delivery evolution, just as we heard from Ms. Kidd here, we are part of the service delivery evolution. 911 is the first public safety entity on scene. And to exclude us from the rest of the provisions in this Oregon revised statutes related to certification and licensure of people who do public safety under the auspices of DPSST, with the exception of PERS, is ludicrous. It was done deliberately back in 91, not by the fault of the legislators, but by the fault of the people who were the employers of these 911 people. No more. Got to stop. If you want your call answered by somebody that's been taken, or been on the job 2 years, we'll keep the law as it is. If you want them there 12, 14 years on average, let's pass this law. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, our final to testify on this will be Maria Keltner and Hasina Squires, AOC and LOC, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Wilson and members of the committee, my name is Maria Keltner. I work with the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties and represent them on workforce type issues, including PERS issues. November, many of the cities and counties and other local government entities got their notice of their new higher PERS rates. And for many of them, it was quite a shock, and you've probably read about that in some of the newspaper accounts and heard it around the Capitol. Since then, we've worked with the PERS actuary, the board, and the staff of PERS to try to understand what's going on with PERS. And both the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities have taken a position that would oppose bills that would increase benefits or expand benefits until we can get PERS costs under control and figure out what in the world is going on. There's been a lot of progress made in that on that route. House Bill 2724 increases the PERS costs by adding telecommunicators. Frequently they're called 911 operators, but there are other titles for those positions, to those that receive the higher police and fire PERS benefits. The PERS actuary estimates that that will increase the cost of PERS benefits for those positions by 3.19% times their payroll. For those entities which most do, that pick up the employer contribution, the employee contribution, the employer's increased cost would be 3.38% of their payroll. three, an example, I wasn't able to call a number of entities, but I did reach the Salem 911 unit, and their increased cost for fiscal year 99-00, I'm not sure how we're going to say that year yet, would be just about $84,000 for 1 year's increased cost for the operators. Now, aside from the cost, in terms of the policy for who's included for police and fire benefits, the best of our research, and there are a couple of different opinions in terms of who was originally eligible for police and fire benefits, but it appears that the shorter lifespan of police officers and firefighters was the original policy decision behind including folks in that group. Their eligibility for full retirement benefits is at a younger age, and the formula, if you are on the formula, is a higher formula. There's also some belief that personal danger on the job is an appropriate criteria for police or fire benefits for PERS. The cities and counties through the league and the association ask you to vote no on House Bill 2724, both on the policy basis and on the increased cost basis.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We have in our association three 911 communications districts, one in Klamath County, one in Columbia County, and then also one in Tillamook County. We also represent two intergovernmental agreement 190s, which would be the Washington County Consolidated Communications Agency. Representative Starr knows all about WACA, and also the Southern Oregon Regional Communication Center Source. I've checked with them. I think I would like to focus my testimony just on the actual cost to the employers. We also oppose this legislation based on the increased cost to employers. We are trying to cope with the mandated increased cost for employer contribution rates that was a result of House Bill 3349 from last session. This would, again, increase employer costs as a percentage of payroll by, as Maria said, 3.19%. What that equates to for WACA, according to their information, they have 61 full-time employees. That would result, this legislation would result in an annual increase of $83,266. For a smaller district, Tillamook 911 Communications District, who has 8.5 full-time employees, it would result the 3.19 as a percentage of payroll and a $9,498 dollar increase. And then for Columbia Communications District, they indicate that it would cost them $21,000 annually. This is not just a one-time cost. This would be an annual cost because the new rate would increase by 3.19% of the payroll. So we urge you to oppose this legislation. I find it personally a little ironic that there's many pieces of legislation floating around dealing with third-tier, fourth-tier PERS, local government pooling of employer contribution rates. How are we going to provide some relief for employer contribution rates and for the local governments who are dealing with mandated costs as a result of House Bill 3349 to be adding increased benefits at this time would seem a little ironic.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What did House Bill 3349 do? You keep referring to that. I don't remember that from last session.
Hasina asked me to respond to that question.
I am no PERS expert, Representative Bowman, trust me.
The House Bill 3349 was a bill that was passed in 1995 to provide a remedy for the taxation of PERS benefits.
Thank you. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to take this opportunity, having had some experience at WACA and their budget committee, seeing how they dealt with this at a local level where we had significant turnovers in these dispatchers. It was rather astonishing to me because of the stress levels these folks are under. And I would submit that with a little bit higher benefit package that turnover may not be as high.
and I'd like to see the costs that would that the agencies would save in the training, because the significant training costs that these folks go through in order to become qualified to serve in this very important position. That said, I'd also just like to thank the 911 dispatchers that are here, and those that aren't here, if you can relay our thanks for your service and your hard work and serving the public. What you do is an invaluable service, really, and I'd just like to take this opportunity to say thank you.
Representative Harper.
He's just mad because he got called a wacko.
I guess just a little bit more there, cost-benefit study, retention versus the cost of PERS. You know, sometimes, if you could do a legitimate, sometimes you'd be surprised. And thirdly, to the 911 dispatchers, thank you also. And I promise I'll quit calling when I forget to share his phone number. I'm going to write it down next time. I'm not going to do it again.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2724, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2725. We've got two more hearings to go in 30 minutes' time, and so just to appreciate any brevity that you may offer us. Mary Botkin, would you come up again with some friends, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. With me is Dr. Reichland, who is a doctor over at the Oregon State Hospital. And he, as many of his colleagues, supervise individuals and treat individuals who are considered to be mentally ill or criminally insane or both. We're asking that they be moved into police and fire as a rectifying situation. If the good doctor worked at the state penitentiary or in any of the corrections facilities supervising many of the same individuals, he would be in police and fire. But because he's chosen to work in a treatment setting rather than a correctional setting, he's not included. And, you know, our union happens to think there's a role for both treatment and correctional. And we don't think, and the client profile is very similar, that the individual should be discriminated against because they've chosen treatment over corrections. And we would like to encourage you to consider moving those folks in the state hospital. We actually only have 25 doctors over there, so it's not a very big group. But I do understand, and I want to make it clear, that the Oregon Public Employees Union will request that they be allowed to amend this bill to include their general service employees over there. And we just want to say that, for the record, everybody who works at the state hospital shares in the risk. We're more than happy to offer up this piece of legislation as a vehicle to include those folks. Understanding that it could weigh the bill down. The good doctor and I have discussed it, and I do think that there comes a point where people have to stand together, and this is probably one of those points. So with that, I'd like Scott to proceed.
Doctor, welcome.
I'm Scott Reichland, MD. I'm a psychiatrist at Oregon State Hospital. I've been there for 12 years. I've prepared one page, of comments that I'm not going to read, but I wanted to distribute to the committee. And I wanted to just go over them briefly and hit the high points. The state hospital treats the most mentally ill and among the most dangerous people in the state. Some people think that being assaulted is part of the job, and I wanted to stress initially that it's not part of the job, and it's a source of burnout, and it's a source of harm for the doctors and other employees at the state hospital. We have a number of programs at the hospital, including the forensic program, which is criminal offenders, the general adult program, child and adolescent, and geriatrics, and all of these programs have a significant level of violent individuals. The physicians and other staff are working with these people on a direct one-to-one basis regularly every day, all day. And although we often think of the criminally insane as the most dangerous, I just wanted to point out that the other areas of the hospital also, that the physicians and the other staff are at serious risk. All of the patients really in the state hospital are there for, and in one way or another, because they can't be tolerated in any other setting. And in most cases, that's because of some kind of behavior problems or violence. The stress level is high. We've had a lot of physician turnover in the last couple of years, particularly in the adult treatment service. At one point, we had one area that had three doctors come and go within a period of about 6 months. At another time, we had one physician administrator covering the work of three doctors because we just didn't have enough staff. In many cases, the patients who are in the hospital need the recommendation of the physician in order to get out, and they want to get out, and it's not always possible to give the positive recommendation. So this leaves us open to threats and attacks. More and more patients have infectious diseases, which complicates the situation. And just finally, I want to point out that psychiatry, even outside the state hospital, can be dangerous. And in the recent past, there have been two murders among psychiatrists, not at the state hospital, but in other settings in Oregon. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks very much. I'd like to call up Viola Haycraft, Jim Hugg, and Stan Mazur-Hart, please.
Hi, Stan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'll let you choose whomever.
Okay. Mr. Chairman Wilson and other members of the committee, I am a mental health specialist at State Hospital, and I do a number of groups on the ward.
Could you identify yourself by
name? Jim Hugg is my name. And we support Hospital also 2725, but we feel that it should have all the people that have contact with the patients on that also. For one of the things is that, for instance, at the state prison has the special management unit, which handles the patients that are mentally ill and have behavioral problems. When they are mentally ill and they cannot manage them there, they send them to the state hospital. And kind of the consensus, talking to some of the psychologists today and some of the other mental health specialists, and they're very hard to distinguish from our standard patients that we have. And of course, the people at the state prison are covered by the fire and police, PERS. Adolescents also are regularly transferred from the Oregon Youth Authorities to the children's unit over there because they can't handle them also, or because of placement, and that they are also covered by fire and police PERS. We deal with many dangerous patients, as the doctor said. I, for myself, have had my left bicep ripped about 5 years ago. I'll never be the same, and there are a number of us that do get hurt. We do have mandatory training in safety and preventing and managing aggressive patients, so we do have that. But once in a while, we do get in trouble with the patients because of the people we're dealing with. One of the things is, once again, like doctors and the nurses from Bell 2725, we're exposed to those type of patients, which are behavioral problems in other institutions, and we do get those people shipped from the community mental health that cannot handle them. The reasons the doctors said.
All right, thank you.
My name is Viola Haycraft, and I'm an office coordinator on the head trauma ward at OSH, and I'm representing non-forensic ward in geriatric. We do get forensic patients on our ward as they have head trauma, so they are better handled on our ward. And I am exposed to this element of danger every day as I enter the ward. I walk past the patients. I also do different types of work that takes me out in the area where the patients are. And I'd just like to tell you about two different experiences I've had since I've been there. And one was when I entered the ward, I was attacked by a patient. He put his arm around my throat and locked it on his other arm. And I managed with my training to know how to get myself positioned to get his arm across my face and not around my throat. Direct care staff came and released me from him, but I can still get hurt very easily. Just last week on Wednesday, Secretary's Day, I was slapped by a Huntington's disease patient, totally unexpected. She stepped in front of me and got me. So all staff that go in any area where patients are at a risk to be attacked, to be hurt. Fortunately, I have never been seriously injured. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Stan Mazerhart. I'm a clinical psychologist and the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. I'm here today on behalf of the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division and the State Hospital. First, I would like to recognize the work that's done by the staff of the State Hospital. These folks and others like them who work at the hospital do great work under very difficult and trying circumstances. There's no question that it's extraordinarily stressful. I am here on behalf of the division and the hospital to neither support nor speak against this bill, but rather to express a concern. House Bill 2725 recognizes physicians and registered nurses, as it's written now, as police officers. My concern is that the staff at the Oregon State Hospital are not police officers, as characterized by this bill, but rather mental health care providers and clinicians providing direct clinical services in a treatment environment. OSH physicians and registered nurses are not guards. They do not receive police officer training and do not have police powers. All OSH employees do receive training at the hospital in order to maintain a safe and orderly environment in order to provide effective treatment to the patients that we serve. Finally, as Jim and Viola have indicated, and as Mary indicated earlier, there would be consideration for considering a couple of bills together. There are actually, I believe, three bills in total that address this particular issue, and would submit that considering the three together would probably give a more systematic and ordered thought to the employees of the hospital being considered under police and fire purpose. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Any questions? All right, thanks very much for your time. All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2725, and we will open a public hearing on House. Pardon me? Oh, yeah. Right. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2964. I'm going to hand the gavel over to Representative Atkinson here for a moment as I go down and plead my case.
Might not be a good day for that.
Yes. Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
He's cleaning his tank first. Yes, we are.
Well, should we tell him the longer he talks, the
harder? Don't talk us out of it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson, we have 15 minutes to go and one bill to do, so if you wouldn't mind keeping your comments brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll certainly honor that, and most people down here generally do, so I appreciate that.
For the record, I am Carl Wilson, District 49 State Representative, Grants Pass, Cave Junction, Oregon. As you may recall from our previous hearing, I introduced this bill to get the fuel flowing again at one of my local airports, the Illinois Valley Airport. However, this is much broader than it may appear at first blush. The State Fire Marshal's Office cut the ability to receive fuel shipments from the commercial supplier when they began enforcing a law and rule that had largely been ignored for quite a number of years. During those years, these small airports continued to receive their fuel directly from fuel dispensing vehicles from the commercial delivery services. These small airports fuel airplanes directly from their own fuel truck, as they cannot afford to have permanent fuel racks. This practice has occurred in aviation since the invention of the airplane, so I assure you it is nothing new, nothing radical. Thankfully, the Fire Marshal's office has given these small airports a reprieve until December 15th, but my small airport, while enjoying this grace period, will still be unable to afford an in-ground rack at the end of that period. House Bill 2964 prohibits the State Fire Marshal from regulating transfer of aircraft fuel from a fuel distributor's tank truck to an aircraft refueling vehicle. Now, lest you think that this legislation is throwing caution to the wind, I'd like to mention that the state cannot legislate common sense.
Mr. Chair, I want to interrupt the testimony to move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2964. Since we're in work session.
If there's no objections.
I have a question before we...
Hold on. Representative Harper.
The Dash 1 talks about commercial air passenger service.
Yes.
What's the definition? Will it preclude a small little FBO from hauling one passenger for hire?
No, it will not. There'll be this pertains to commercially recognized air carriers.
And that's a definition that's
known
by the fire marshal.
Yes, we had two choices to make. We had that, and there was another classification we could have chosen, but we chose to go for this since it was more readily understandable.
This won't preclude the small amount of the people you're trying to help.
No, no.
Just because they have one charter.
No, okay. No, it will not.
Mr. Chair.
Actually, the chair would like to let the chair finish his comments real quickly.
No, we're going to be a no if he keeps talking.
Please continue in just a second.
All right, I'll hasten on. So, lest you think that the state is throwing caution to the wind, I do want to say that by passing this, you can't legislate common sense. The commercial fuel haulers, by their own company safety rules, deliver fuel on a regular basis. Common sense would tell you that no employee is going to risk accident or injury when transferring fuel. The airport fuel truck operator also has his own rules to live by and does not need the state's help in regulating safety. I've always been amazed when looking at the instructions that are printed on the cellophane laundry bags that your dry cleaning is returned in. It always says, this bag is not a toy. Nobody needs to tell me that. Neither does anyone need to tell a commercial fuel company that the transfer of fuel into any receptacle is a serious matter. That's why we need to cut this bit of unneeded bureaucracy and let the fuel flow without interruption at a number of small airports in Oregon that simply cannot afford to comply with the unneeded rules. Those airports that we would like to help by this include the Illinois Valley Airport, Prineville, Ashland, Aurora, Lebanon, and Malala. That concludes my testimony.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, why was the population number taken away in the Dash 1 amendments?
No particular reason other than the fact that there may be some dispute on what population figures would be pertinent to a particular airport, whether you were talking about the city right next to the airport or the county, if it was a county airport or something like that. So we chose just to pull that out and make it perhaps a little bit more descriptive.
I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Bowman.
I guess that I was a lot more comfortable with the limit of 25,000 population because it really was targeted on the population you're attempting to help.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that someone can look at this and think that they can come to the Portland airport and fill themselves, and that would present some major problems.
and I don't know how to fix it.
Chair Atkinson and Representative Bowman, this would, once again, we go back to the issue here of we're talking about airports that don't have your fuel racks, and this legislation is only directed to the airports that don't have the fuel racks, the approved in-ground fuel racks and so forth, and this would deal strictly with those airports that have been traditionally filling airplanes out of tank trucks, and there aren't very many in the state who do that.
Any further questions?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Just a statement that you can't legislate common sense. That was somewhat the foundation of my political philosophy of legislating common sense. So I just want to get that on the record. That will be an eye vote.
Thank you. At this point, entertain any motion.
Move dash one amendments into 2964.
Representative Sinceri moves the dash ones into House Bill 2964. Any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2964 to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Sinceri moves House Bill 2964 as amended to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I have a question, Mr. Chair. When you did the dash ones, you said any discussion and you just went ahead and adopted it. That's not the same as voting on the dash one amendment.
Discussion.
I believe under
Jackson.
So I'd like to
I heard
to the dash one amendment.
Okay.
Any other objections to the dash one?
Okay, we have a motion on the floor. Is there any other discussion on the bill, on the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no vote until I check with my airport to make sure that this does not in any way inhibit their ability to regulate small one-passenger planes that are coming through my airport, and will reserve the right to change my vote on the floor.
Mr. Chairman, did you note for the record the objection to the dash one amendments being?
Yes. Any other discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
No.
Deckard?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sinceri?
Yes.
Thompson?
Votes aye.
Having the fire. Amount of votes to pass House Bill 2964 moves the floor with the due pass recommendation, and I believe Representative Wilson will be the carrier.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Completed the order of our agenda. I now conclude the meeting of House and General Government.